This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's been less than a week since the 115th Congress was sworn in, and already science is in the hot seat. A bill introduced this week by House Republican Eric Paulson threatens to pull the plug on the medical device tax introduced under Obamacare. And while you may worry that this new Congress may strip funding for essential research in global warming, genetics, green energy, and medicine, science does have a few advocates on the Hill. And one of them is Congressman Bill Foster, a Democrat from Illinois, and former physicist at Fermilab. He's also one of the only two remaining members of Congress with a degree in science. And he's the last physicist there. You could think of him as sort of the other science guy named Bill. Congressman Bill Foster represents Illinois' 11th District. He sits on the Committee for Science, Space, and Technology. Welcome, Congressman.
Well, happy to be here, Ira.
You've sort of taken over the role that we used to have for Rush Holt on our program.
Well, that's right. I think when I first came to Congress in the special election to replace Dennis Hastert, I was the third PhD physicist in the U.S. Congress. And unfortunately, the other two have retired. And now at this point, I think I am the only PhD scientist of any kind that we have some, political scientists, a mathematician. But it feels sort of lonely sometimes.
I was going to say that. You sound as lonely as the Maytag repairman in the job there. Do you really feel that you don't have others to talk to who share your interests?
Well, no, there's a lot of interest in science and a lot of support, frankly, certainly on my side of the aisle. I think, at this point, most of Washington is preoccupied just really trying to read between the lines of the Trump administration's appointments and, the midnight tweets and so on, trying to discern what the science policy might be in the coming administration. Mm-hmm. I guess back in the times of the Romans, they used to look at bird entrails to try to see into the future. And now we're reduced to listening to the tweets from the president as sort of the bird entrails of the 21st century.
Some of the tweets are actually announcements, sort of like the Secretary of Energy, the EPA. Do they bode well for science?
It's a mixed bag. Some of them, for example, James Mattis, despite his appellation as Mad Dog Mattis, as the Secretary of Defense, he signed on to a report acknowledging climate change as a real threat to our national security. And has a very, very intellectual reputation as someone who's a deep thinker on this stuff. On the other hand, his EPA designee is Scott Pruitt, is a very strong climate denier with a history of suing the EPA over environmental protections. Tom Price, the designee for Health and Human Services, has repeatedly pushed and voted to cut science funding, and so that's not so good news. Mm-hmm. Rick Perry is an interesting case. It's easy to sort of, poke fun at the fact that he's now running the Department of Energy and that he couldn't even remember its name during one of the debates. But in fact, the Department of Energy, can and has survived with political employees, appointees running it. And what's important at this point is that the next level of appointees below Governor and soon-to-be Secretary Perry be people with good technical credentials and a real understanding of the mission of the Department of Energy, its scientific mission, its mission to maintain the nuclear arsenal and other things.
And while he comes from a state that's, known for its oil production, it's also one of the biggest wind energy producing states.
That's correct. And he was a very strong proponent of wind power when he was governor of Texas. So, we're crossing our fingers here. Mm-hmm. I think that people are perhaps most concerned about Mick Mulvaney, who's the designee for the Office of Management and Budget. So he'll be preparing the budgets for the Trump administration. And I serve with him on the Financial Services Committee, and he sort of became locally famous, I think, last September, when he put out a post questioning whether there was any need for any federally funded research at all, which hopefully will not represent his opinion when he's actually in charge of preparing the Trump administration's budget.
Because we know from past experience in all levels and all walks of life, when budgets get cut, a lot of times science is the first thing to go. science budgets.
Yep, and it just has to do with the fact that the damage, when you damage long-term scientific research, it damages the economy severely, but not immediately. And so you can be a hero by balancing the budget this year and never acknowledge the damage that happens decades from now when we're missing the the sort of research that ultimately advances our society and saves the government a huge amount of money. You see that in medical care, for example, where, you know, a third of all of our spending is in diabetes, and within a dozen or so years, another third is going to be Alzheimer's. If you could come up with a low-cost cure for either one of those, it would solve the long-term fiscal crisis in Medicare. Cutting research in general is a very unwise thing.
I have found over the years, and we've been on a year 25 years, I've been covering this a lot longer, is that when a member of Congress is against something, when they discover that a member of their family suddenly has come down with that kind of disease that might be saved by basic research, they sort of just turn around and start funding it. You hate that.
That's right.
To wish that on anybody, but that's sort of been a history of some of this funding.
Yeah. But there's also a danger of having Congress micromanage research budgets, too, because, you know, even if you're concerned about a specific disease, the best path towards getting a cure might be to do many years of fundamental research to understand the underlying mechanisms instead of just immediately trying to go to clinical trial with things without any strong scientific basis. And so, really, there's a right level at which Congress should manage the budget that doesn't involve micromanaging.
Does the 21st Century Cures Act fall under that micromanaging idea, where it's going to say we should be sending money here, sending money there?
Well, in the general, it's a mixed bag. It's almost everything Congress passes. First and foremost, it authorizes, I think, of $4.8 billion of new funding for the National Institutes of Health, but it authorizes it. That's different than appropriated it, which sounds like, technical Washington insider jargon. But what that means is that there's a large number of members of Congress who say how much they love science, and they will vote for these things that authorize the money to be spent. And then if you ask how did they vote on budgets that actually provide enough money to fund these things, they voted against them. And so you have to look at both sides of this. The 21st Century Cures Act had a bunch of good things. And in fact, it had $1.6 billion earmarked for Alzheimer's, which is wonderful, assuming the budgets that will be passed actually support that level of funding.
Are there any bipartisan issues in science you think Congress should work on this year or will be working on?
Well, I serve on the Science Committee. My two committees are Financial Services and the Science Committee. I guess at some point, the leadership in Congress thought that, well, if we only have one PhD scientist, that maybe we should put him on the Science Committee. And so that's where I sit. And and it's sort of issue by issue. That there are some issues, things like climate change, where we immediately just go into our partisan corners and start, spewing the usual talking points. There are other ones where I found that we can have very thoughtful discussions across the aisle. An example of that was human genetic engineering, which is, due to the breakthroughs that have happened in the last several years, it is no longer science fiction to contemplate making changes to the genetic makeup of people and their children that will carry on through the generations. And because of the importance of this, really to the future of mankind, I was able to convince the Republican chairman of the House Science Committee that we should have a hearing on this. And I was told that it was one of the best ever attended hearings of the House Science Committee. And it's because of the importance of this. And as a result of this whole push into trying to understand how we will deal with this from a legislative and legal point of view, that there was actually the National Academy initiated a year-long international study. It's going to be reporting out actually in a couple months here, looking at how we will regulate this internationally. Because the number of issues that are really really crucial to the long-term destiny of mankind here.
But there have been some issues. We actually had a researcher on our program who felt all his research was subpoenaed by the federal government, by Congress, and FBI banged on his door. He said, he told us, demanded his all his laptops, his computers, everything else, his records. And he said, "Where's your search warrant?" And they said, "We don't need one. We're Congress." And yep. That's seen as intimidation. Wasn't it the same committee you were talking about that asked for those records?
Yep, that is correct. And that's one of the things that we've been, a battle we've been fighting continually, usually in the guise of something related to climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, you know, I think if you Google my name along with Bill Foster and Greenland together, you're led to a hearing that we had in the Science Committee. There's a Washington Post story on it. And some video where one of the Republican witnesses, a lawyer, was trying to convince me that it was a matter of scientific debate whether or not it was a good thing that the Greenland ice sheet was melting. And so this was a, you know, I try to be as respectful and as I can, but there are times when it's a challenge.
Let's talk about your history. You have a long and very successful history as a business person, and then decide to go into mm-hmm. Congress when in your 50s. What made you decide to do that?
Well, you know, as you say, I went in the well-trodden path from theatrical stage lighting to high-energy particle physics to the United States Congress. So I'm just another one of them. I'm sure you've heard many,
of
them on your show. Yeah. But, you know, when I was 19, my little brother and I started this company in our basement at the dawn of the microprocessor era to use microprocessors to make theater lighting controllers. And so the company now, through the long efforts of my little brother, has now... it's got about 70% of the U.S. market for all theater lighting equipment. And I guess most significantly in a lot of people's eyes, went back when I was maybe 25, I designed and programmed the controller for the Disneyland Main Street Electrical Parade. And so that was my sort of first career where I worked at that for most of a decade. Then I went back to Harvard grad school and became to my first love, I guess, which was physics. And got a degree and spent about 25 years as a high-energy particle physicist, most of that at Fermi National Accelerator Lab, where I was on the committee the experiment that discovered the top quark, the heaviest known form of matter, and then got into designing accelerators. And actually the last of the giant accelerators at Fermi Lab was one that I invented and led the teams that built the magnets for it. So the question of then why on God's green earth, you know, would someone with an interesting career in business and in science go into politics? My quick answer to that is that I fell prey to the family's recessive gene for adult onset political activism, which sort of tragically runs in my family. My dad was actually he was a scientist. He got a chemistry degree from Stanford and during World War II designed fire control computers for the Navy. And most of the way through the war started getting these reports of how many people had been killed by his team's equipment, you know, this week, and became very unhappy with the idea of his technical skills being used to hurt people.
Yeah.
And so he came back from the war, thought about it for a while, and decided that he would become a civil rights lawyer, and actually ended up writing much of the enforcement language behind the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Let me interrupt you just for a second. It's a great story. Remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flato talking with Congressman Bill Foster from Illinois. And so he then went into the civil rights movement?
Yeah. So he stepped away from his career in science and became a civil rights lawyer, which he saw as the great moral challenge of his generation. And so it was actually reading his papers after he passed away not so long ago that I started thinking about, you know, this fundamental question that everyone has to answer, which is what fraction of your life you spend in service to your fellow man.
Yeah.
It's a question that science does not help you with at all.
That's why we're here. Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Cynthia in Burridge, Illinois. Hi, Cynthia.
Hello.
Hey, Cynthia, a constituent.
Absolutely, and a teacher. I was just going to make a plug for two of our Argon scientists here. Doug Sisterson and Seth Darling wrote a really good book, if you're trying to talk to people. It's actually titled How to Change Minds About Our Changing Climate. Very accessible, very articulate, very short, too, which makes it probably better for some of our maybe congressional leaders to read. But my question, and I'll take any answer you have off here, politically, given all of the appointments made by Donald Trump, I don't need to mention him, and his friendship with Vladimir Putin, how do you think the motivation of driving and keeping oil prices high, obviously that's what Russia would prefer, will impact the acceptance, support, and future investment for alternative energies and climate change research? And is anyone looking at these associations close enough and with enough alarm?
Thank you, Cynthia. I only have a minute to go, so we'll see if we can get that all out in.
Yeah, well, there's no quick answer to that. You know, the jury is still out on that. The degree to which the whenever a new administration is formed, usually the people that form that administration have a variety of positions, and ultimately incoming President Trump is going to have to decide which of those really reflect his long-term priorities. You know, I hope he sees the value of homegrown energy and green energy as really an advantage to the United States.
I have one last quick question for you. We've been on the air 25 years, and we've had on many times in the past Dr. Leon Lederman, and I know you probably know who he is.
Oh,
I was wondering if you know how he's doing.
Yeah, well, he's actually been diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Right, I knew that.
And so he is a, you know, when I first ran for Congress, Leon Lederman was a huge help. When I first ran for Congress, my campaign was endorsed by 31 Nobel Prize winners. And so that was because Leon Lederman went, and on my behalf, he spammed the entire Nobel laureates distribution list, which actually is something that exists, on my behalf, and said, when this guy, Bill Foster, calls you up, take his phone call. And so that resulted in a couple days of my life calling up 31 Nobel Prize winners to endorse my campaign. And so, you know, Leon has been great. He is he is slowing down, and but is one of the great American scientists.
I go way back with him also. Congressman, thank you for taking time to be with us today, and good luck to you and everybody else in Congress.
All right. Thank you.
Congressman Bill Foster, U.S. House of Representatives, sits on this Committee for Science, Space, and Technology.